What Now, episode 51. Dan is back. We found a free day. Magnificent. I know we promised we wouldn't be back till January, but here it is. Hang on to your hats.
What is this? What Now?
Hi, this is Derek Myers, and this is What Now? I'll be joined by Dan Lee as a co-host, and we'll talk about whatever we damn well want to talk about, mainly being old dads. But we'll see. What? Okay, so what happened, Oz? When I pressed record and then sat down, getting ready to stare Dan down and get ready to start the show, and
because
I got
you're a
spam
sad
call.
Old bloke, the only calls you get are from Mumbai. I don't. The only people that call
Church
me
Church Street, Richmond. She said.
Bullshit.
That's what she said. I believe it.
The only people that call me are my mother and strangers from Mumbai in a noisy room.
We didn't technically start recording, so I don't have to buy us fucking slap. Hang on a sec. I'll get you.
All right.
Hello, Derek speaking. Good, thanks. Hang on. We spoke in the past and you'd rang me up to try and sell me a website production product at this. My website's down, is it? Oh. Mm. Hey, listen, my problem is that you said to me, we chatted a little while ago and you were busy. I may have a little bit of sort of dementia, right? But I promise you, I would never have said, call me back another day. I would have said, don't ever call me back ever again. There's only one way I ever go, because I do not ever use a company. It's my policy. It's in our constitution that I can never use a company that has rang me. It's that simple. This is really – so constitutionally I can't use your service. So it's up to you. How much is your time worth? Oh, yeah, okay.
You could ring her back.
I really appreciate it. But let's go back to the I can't ever use your company constitutionally.
Yeah. So if you want a chinwag, just a bit of a chat.
Yeah.
We could solve your problems all since right. We're live.
Bye-bye. Are we live? Oh, yes. Fortunately, I pressed record before that happened.
What is she trying to flog you now?
I know that.
Is there anything any of us could really want anymore? We're just disgusting consumption machines. Is there anything else we could possibly need? We could convince ourselves we do. But really, I mean, come on.
All right. Now, that's going to be an interesting cold start. Look, we were so ready for a cool start, videos, you name it. Well.
We didn't get the phone call? You didn't film the phone call happening?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, it was more audio anyway, that only I could hear. I didn't record it either. Oh, I mean, okay. My response, you got recorded. My wife says, you were so rude to that person. Was I rude?
Jesus Christ. You weren't rude then. You just talked to – what you do – yeah, I don't know what you do.
Look, this technique –
My old man says, can you give me your phone number? I'll call you back because I've got to get some – you know what he does? He tries to recruit them to do something else. Yeah. He goes, no, I'll tell you what. Yeah. I need someone to go down and pick up some dry cleaning for me. Do you reckon you could? I'll tell you what, I'll call you back because I need someone to fix the back fence. Mm-hmm. Do you reckon you could do that or advise me on? My wife's giving me trouble. Is there? So, like, that's what dad does.
Do you want to be a pal?
He gives them another option.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know, I find that one there that we just did. And we have started the show.
He's talking about
doing something that we haven't
marketers.
Said yet. So we're going to go back and start the show in a minute. So we've already started the show just to get your head around.
You and you're going back and restarting the show in the middle.
I'm actually explaining it to you.
But you're not, right? No, because not the it's always in there. You always say, this bit will be cut out and you'll be hearing something we've already said, but it will happen in the past and the future and the other thing. But you don't. You end up leaving
it
there.
That's the best part of Doctor Who, trying to work out the fuck.
Your glasses
monkeys.
Are fogging up. I
know,
can tell
I'm
you.
Freaking out. It's the cameras. Oh, we used to be pretty chilled.
Yeah.
Did you catch the
excellent.
This show is called Danny's Back.
Yeah. Now, what were you saying I interrupted?
Don't even know.
Yeah. See, that's the great thing. I can interrupt you.
Oh, we've got so much
lost,
to catch up on. There's no point in even starting. Right, let's look. The most exciting thing going on right now is Dan's play Bottomless.
Yeah.
We've gone on about it a bit, but now we've got more material. I've seen it.
You did. Derek came to opening night.
Yeah, I've seen it. So I've got something to say.
He pretended he knew what it was about. No, you guys did amazingly well. You got everything. Yeah. I think you might be the only ones. It's probably because I told you beforehand.
No, you did not. I've got the transcripts. I know exactly what you've told me.
Right, yeah.
We don't secretly chat before the show.
No.
So exciting things. It's pretty good. I've got something to read. Now, this is from your – oh, shit. This is why we don't read stuff on podcasts. But so the show's been going for a week now. And there's a week to go, roughly. Something like that.
Yeah.
And it's going well?
Yeah. It's going very well. It's almost full each night, so.
I don't want to give away too early that I thought it was grouse.
Right.
Because, you know, we've got to keep the audience wondering whether it's going to be awkward or not. But it was awesome. And now I come from it's a little bit easier with me because I've got that 90s fringe horror history. Haircut. I probably have.
Yeah, it's the same haircut you had.
You've had the same haircut for quite some time.
A long time.
Yeah. So let's have a look.
Got the same 90s what?
I'm zooming in. There's a trick.
I've
got new gizmos, guys, and if you look on, well, we don't know where you can see it, but somewhere this video.
The only reason gizmos get bought anywhere is because of blokes hiding from their families.
Back to the play. This is important. So it was grouse, but I went in with three main terrors. Right. Back in the 90s when every man and his dog put on a fringe show.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, lots of angst and lots of stuff going on, and it was always a bit awkward, and but you had to go to so many of them. Everyone was doing it.
Yeah.
They were the new arsehole.
Yeah, like a podcast.
Exactly. But no one has to sit there and look us in the eye while they're going, oh, these
Western countries, the incidence of loneliness and unfulfillment and discontent in Western countries is skyrocketing, and so is podcasting.
There you go.
Because, you know.
No, well, it's yin and yang, isn't it? Podcasting is trying to counteract loneliness.
If you're not quite ready to kill yourself, start a podcast. That should be the slogan. Thinking of suicide, why not start a podcast first?
Well, it could be an alternative.
Yeah. Well, it could save a lot of lives. Anyway, go on. What were you saying? Oh, you are three horrors.
There was the fringe terror.
The fringe terror.
Right. So one thing that I got out of it was this was a play that was devoid of angst. And but still anguish without angst. A story, a comedy, tragedy, or whatever you want to call it, with anguish, of course, but without this. I don't know whether I know what the word angst means, but to me, it's like people carrying on a bit too much about how they feel just with their fingers, and you know what I mean? I don't know.
The review I was most terrified of, which turned out to be good, was the one from The Age from Cameron Woodhead, and he said a similar thing, that it had the authenticity and the kind of the authenticity of a true story without the earnestness.
Right. Can I try and read it out?
If you want. But I'm glad that was noticed, because I was very keen not to make it because it's a personal story about alcoholism. I didn't want it to be this kind of self-indulgent sort of romanticizing of the horror. Clear about that. So that's why it has this kind of frivolous light feel, particularly in the beginning before it.
Well, I thought,
kicks you in the nuts, you know, at the end.
That night after the play, I got home and I said to my wife, Australian theatre is in such need of a – hang on, lost the page – of the kind of new voice Lee brings to the stage. And she said –
You said Lee, did you?
She said, Derek – Derek, it's hard to believe this is Lee's first play with text as expertly crafted as this. And I said, well, darling, Lee's – tone and language is at times thrillingly potent, and by turns as comically incisive as it is poetic. All right. Well,
at least
I'm
this
not
is heartfelt and you're not reading it from anywhere.
These are proper people. There's not just me and my wife to be. These are reviews. That was Arts Hub, Theatre Press, and the Australian Book Review.
Mm. And you know,
the Age one sounds even better. I'm pretty happy.
The good thing was that some of the reviews that weren't as keen on it, none of them thought it was a complete dud. Like they all found good things in it, and some liked it more than that. But even the ones that had problems with it, I didn't really disagree with them. The things they cited as issues, I was like, yeah, that's. I can see how that mightn't work for you.
Yeah.
And you know, it being shorter than I intended it to be, it doesn't give you time to really let a lot of the stuff sink in, because there's some pretty big sort of ideas and sort of symbolism in it and I also wanted to get a bit of that oppressive heat and repetition happening, which is taken out of it. But what it has instead is an exponential curve, which was a deliberate choice on the director's part to make it go slowly, 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 woof, like that.
Exactly.
So, you know.
It was like there was a couple of times when I, you know, you're trying to think because you do a podcast and you think you're some kind of journo.
Mm.
I'm just changing the camera angle, sorry.
Are there
was
more
a couple
cameras?
Of times when I – no, but the one – look at the little screen. It's okay.
Yeah, I can't see the little screen.
And so there's the main thing, it's you and me. And then I can – it just takes a part of it. So it will be a blurry low res, and that's the deck.
Oh, my God.
And then, look, what do we have here? Well, you don't have to worry about it. I'm saying that for the audience. But that's actually the reviews I was just reading out to the website. Wow. So it's good gizmos, and that's Sean's. It's a good picture.
Well, we can
Sean's
go show. On YouTube.
This will be a video with good sound because it's putting this audio through.
We better say something fucking poignant then. Something
we have to look poignant.
Yeah.
But during what I was saying was because it's all about me, even though it's your magical play and all that. It's more about my experience at the play.
Well, of course it is.
Yeah. And I tell you what, two things came to mind. While watching it, and it was, oh my God, I nearly lost consciousness during that scene. You know what I mean? Like you were talking about exponential.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Not through terror, but just that the admiration of, I don't know whether it's the artistic person or the director or the staff. I don't know who does all this shit, right? Mm. I assume the director in conjunction with whoever wrote the obviously there's a build up of actual what's going on, narrative. Right. But yeah, the way it just got intense without seeming like an irritating, fucking deafening Fringe kind of episode.
Well, it was
Fringe. I make it sound like Fringe is great. Right.
Yeah.
But it was just a thing when so many of my friends were doing it and we had to go.
Oh, yeah.
Dancing and
I mean, there was still plenty of people I knew who went to this show and afterwards kind of went, yeah, the fence was good, wasn't it? Yeah.
The fence was good.
Yeah. But, you know, like you could tell they're a bit unsure.
But you
try
and think of something else. Like, oh, you know, like your play was good, mate. I nearly lost consciousness a couple of times. Like you've got to really be – you've got to know how much time you're going to have to tell the backstory of your first comment. Like the fence was really good. I liked how it made the whole thing simple so it was all about the people.
Yeah.
You know, and the feature set was in people's minds. It was the castle wall.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever, you know, the prison wall.
Like, yes.
Don't want to give too much away.
Yeah. But it's spoiler alert. It's there's a lot going on in it. Mm. And a lot of it is it's what someone said that it was a slippery. And that's the other thing is it's meant to be, which is not a satisfactory way to make a play. Like because it's trying to create a visceral effect of that kind of difficulty grasping what's being told to you in relation to blackout alcoholics. Like if your life keeps getting chopped up and segmented and bisected by big periods of no memory, then it's hard for you to even grasp the continuity of your own life and what's going on. Yeah. So say you're trying to change, say you're trying to, you know, have the appropriate epiphanies and realizations to get sober. Mm. If you're going into blackout for 2 or 3 days at a time, in the midst of that, it's hard to even get your feet on.
Oh,
so there's a problem with the play straight up. So when people were saying, you know, it's hard to get a hold of, and some of the stories felt like red herrings, I can go, well, okay, fair enough. It does do that. And it'll depend on what you hear, when you hear it, and whether it strikes you. And we had to make choices about, you know, there's a lot in the play that if you don't hear this line here, something else later on won't land as hard, you know?
Yeah.
And if you just happen to cough at that moment or like, so it's a bit, these are things I'm a lot more aware of now with subsequent plays.
Okay. Yeah.
These are things that are very risky things to do, and you don't, it takes the kind of bravado and naivety of a first play to even attempt it, really.
So you're saying that you write in safety nets so that an important point can't be lost because something happened or someone
Because you know when you're watching a play, you don't hear every line. You suddenly you drift off because you're thinking about something that was said before, or you hear a sound from outside the theatre that makes you. But there's a lot in this play where you only get at one chance.
Yeah.
So it does make it harder. It also means if actors drop a line, like they forget this line, it can blow out the a whole strand of the rest of the play.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There's lots of stuff I've learned from this about that and the risks that this thing has taken.
Yeah. It's amazing. How thick's your skin?
I'm all right with the reviews. Well, they've been largely pretty good. But I'm trying to be good at taking the criticism.
Mm.
But, you know, I've never really had criticism that I haven't seen coming.
Yeah.
I think I'm so analytical of my own work that I at least go, I think people might misunderstand this and think that.
Mm.
I don't know, it's never a great surprise to me. It might be wrong. I might think, oh, no, I don't agree with that. I think they just missed something.
Mm.
Or I might go, well, that's probably because I didn't. Next time I'll make this point a bit more strongly if everyone's. This is why I had to get a play produced. So I get a chance to see whether my language and my kind of and my storytelling lands effectively. So if everyone comes back and says, I didn't get that, then I can go look back at it and go, okay, so there's something about the way I'm saying that that's just not landing with people, and what is that? But I can't know that until people have failed to understand. But remember, I've had the benefit of 7 years inside the world of the play.
So
I can't, it's very hard for me to go, what I think is being spoon-fed and obvious might not be at all, or it might be the opposite. I might go too far. Anyway.
But something I admired was it was probably like once I start thinking about someone's craft, number one, it gives you more things to think about while you're experiencing that type of craft, like because you're a playwright. I remember years ago when my friend Mavik, she was writing, you know, writing for all kinds of
TV
things.
She
was writing for Neighbours and stuff like that. So I could sit there and just go, oh, imagine trying to think of what he's going to say. And to write the little conversations. And then so during your play, the things that were going on weren't plot lines. Like some of the things, like some dramatic things, maybe a bit of comedy relief or whatever, something that had a bit of a laugh in it. But what they were saying was this happens all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it was like, oh, I feel clever. It's like getting a difficult quiz question. You know what I mean? I feel clever and I'm enjoying this personally because I reckon I've got clearly I'm being set into the fact that this is a routine. These are the regulars. This is what happens all the fucking time.
But
this guy charging in, it sounds like there's a big drama going on, but we know almost instantly, I don't know how, I don't remember the words that people said, but you knew almost instantly that this was a routine. Probably the casual, the woman running the place wasn't going, oh, my God, what should we do? You know, like I just thought it was clever. And
you've got to, the trick is somehow, because the closer you get to the play, the less able you are to look at it.
Yeah. And then suddenly you've got all these people like me who've been to a play once every 20 years, apart from the second Fear, and that was the Moorabbark Theatre Group play where my mum runs a theatre, as we've said before, and, you know, you've got to go there and you've got to
Yeah.
Watch the old.
There's a bit watch of obligation.
The, vicar,
to
the
that.
Dead vicar fall out of the closet and have a bit of a laugh. And it is funny in the end. Yeah. But whatever reason.
It's a social community interest. It's the sort of thing they make a play about.
Yeah.
Is a community theatre group. But the trick for me with that, with writing that plays like that, especially this one that's about people having to get something. There's a twist in the play that you want people to get ultimately.
Yeah.
It's meant to have an effect on people like that. So the thing with that is you want people, like you said just now, to feel clever.
Yes.
But it's a fine line between helping people to feel clever and making them feel stupid.
Yeah.
So it's like you go slightly too far and they just bail out on it because they feel like they're an idiot.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's very, and then the problem is, so if I pitch it perfect for you, then that's going to be different for whoever's sitting next to you. So you're trying to pitch it for one person and then you're trying to think of a sort of generalized audience member. But
if that's pitch, impossible. And then you'd start going, all right, I'm going to pitch, I got to have 20 things that are going to make this guy feel clever. And then I'm going to have a few laughs here because that guy won't go to the theatre unless there's a few giggles. And then that person, if they don't feel sad, they feel they've been cheated. And there must be a million different factors.
But
you're not going to do any art because you're pandering.
Yeah.
But then you're not just asking people to look at it. They're asking people to pay money and go there and sit down.
Yeah. But the great thing I think about when if people have a very specific and strong voice in their writing, once you have multiple works up, think of it in terms of filmmakers. So Wes Anderson, for example, right? Or Tarantino or whoever. In the beginning, everyone, a cross-section of everyone goes to it. And some of them, it'll be like, fuck, this is terrible.
Yeah.
Like, for example, Wes Anderson does this kind of weird non-naturalism, quirky thing that isn't everyone's cup of tea. So it'll get... You'll have people really responding badly and some good. But as they go on in their career, people now you think of Wes Anderson, you go in your head, you go Royal Tenenbaums, blah, 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 and you know what to expect. No one's going to his.
Which is the trap, again, for him.
But it's good and bad.
It's like Jimi Hendrix, you know.
But at least
getting
people,
fed up being playing with his teeth and stuff like that.
No, but you can innovate in different ways then. Once you've taught them your language, then you can go deeper. The problem for me at the moment with Bottomless has always been there's a real style to it and every theatre company that has a crack at it tries to tailor it to suit their audience.
Yep.
But if I was really well known, no one who would come to the play unless they liked what I do. And then I could go as deep as I wanted into my particular style.
Yeah, yeah.
So those people that have a particular voice, in a way, it just opens it up to go further with that. In the beginning, you're trying to have it both ways. You're trying to hedge your bet. I mean, you can't. You've got to just do what you do. This is what I've learned by, well, when MTC tried to do it, we changed it a lot. Then we went back and got rid of that draft.
Right.
Once we left there, because it just stripped the life out of it.
Yeah, yeah. But then again, if you're under that scenario, the hypothetical scenario you just put out then where people were coming because they knew your work and they dig it and then you can go deeper, would you then possibly, if you didn't want to go deeper, would you be obliged to go deeper because your whole shtick is you're going to blow their mind in a whole nother way?
Like, well, then so, you have the problem. It's like Missy with her music, right? You do it a certain way and then you build an audience who love that style of music. Sort of semi-acoustic singer-songwriter, guitar and piano stuff. And then once you've gone as deep as you think you can go into that, then you suddenly do something different and then you have to just hope that your audience come with you or you get a new audience because you've got a big enough kind of reach, I suppose. And filmmakers do that too, or playwrights, and they're with varying degrees of success.
Yeah.
But at least you get to really go into the thing you're doing rather than hovering in this mediocre land in the middle where you're just trying to be everyone to everything everyone. It's such a long difficult process to get something.
She is so good. I'm a bit struck by your missus.
Oh, right.
That I watched the ABC TV show in the Spiegel tent. It was emotional. It's so good.
Do you know the bit that she
you can miss that. And sometimes it's awkward if you have to say, I didn't really know your work, you know. But then when you're 52, it's all right because you can easily just miss shit. Mm. I was living in the UK for 6 months, so I missed your whole early career sort of thing. Mm. But it's just a different thing when you're hanging around watching punk bands and stuff like that.
Yeah, but completely.
But amazing. Mm. Australia's favourite daughter.
Yeah, it's
I don't
funny,
even want to share it with Australia
they're,
now.
They're so. Starting, the language is changing since the Best Of album and that show and – She's moved into National Treasure territory.
Yeah, in PK's wing.
Yeah, well, there's a point at which you become you. At first, you're the new thing, and coming.
Yeah,
the girl next door or whatever. Then, at some point, you reach National Treasure, and people start talking in that sort of language.
The grown ups love you as much as the kids.
Yeah.
There's so much.
Which is good, but it's also these flags for where you are at your career. It's suggesting you won't be here much longer. It's like at what – like
you could take – yeah. You could take
it any way you want.
You could take it anyway, but if someone says National Treasure, what are you going to do? Get hurt? No, not really.
I felt a bit funny that my play – the general language around my play with the reviewers and stuff was, you know, of emerging and –
First
you know,
play.
Great to see what he'll do from here and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, I'm fucking 46. I don't know if I'm going to do anything else from here. Like I felt like I imagined myself being 23 and being at the start of some magnificent career. And I'm, you know, before we even got this play into rehearsal, I was wanting to bail out of it. I wanted to bail out of it 2 years ago. and it was only the theatre that were going, no, we're going to do it. And I go, are you sure? Maybe we should just let it go. I mean, this is too, you know, fuck. So it's, yeah. But one thing I do know is I'll keep writing and there's no way around that. Whether I'll try to, I think the next play that I end up doing will be me directing it with two actors at Fringe or something where I don't have to worry about getting $120,000 and I don't have to worry about – but it may be because I've got a slight record now of plays, even though one was overseas, maybe I can get those people to come to my smaller shows. Anyway.
I don't know how you do it. All these positive reviews and people going, that was great. And, you know, you kind of try and stare people down and I'm assuming you stare people down and work out whether they're just saying that because they have to, whether your baby's really ugly or whether people are just telling you it's cute
now,
or whatever. But you know, reviewers, they don't fuck about, do they? I can't cope with even someone saying, my back got up when they said it was your first play. I went, oh, he's done another play. What? Fucking bullshit.
You know what? I don't mind people not liking what I do or having good. I don't have a problem with that. I just don't like people being cunts to me. Like if people are just nasty, that's what worries me these days. I feel like I'm pretty good at, like I said, the things that they criticised about it. I was like, I can take that on and think about it. Maybe it would have been different if they totally shit canned it. But I don't know. I think I'm much better at that now. It's partly from the recovery, the booze recovery process, and having to face all sorts of horrible shit about myself. Like I've got a fair bit of resilience now for hearing how shit my behaviour's been or whatever. I can look at character traits that aren't very attractive and go, well, I've got to do something about that. Or I don't beat myself up as bad as I used to. So therefore it doesn't hurt me as much when other people do it. Cause I can go, well, that's reasonable that you would.
So one of my thoughts was, are you going to be a one trick pony because you've used up this experience and you're in Broome in the recovery centre.
Oh, right.
Like, what are you going to do, go and spend 7 years in an opium den somewhere so that you can then talk about that? No. Like, if you used it up, then I thought, perhaps this is the building blocks, like doing the, you know, that high altitude training
Yeah.
Like if you take away in production, you were talking about a while back the difficulty because you were dealing with some indigenous issues in the play that became super tricky with people on board, whether that was fair or not, and here and that. But there was no indigenous issues in the play.
No, there isn't.
At all.
No. So if anything, the thing that I was conscious of is that the story of addiction and denial and convincing yourself that you don't have the problem and you can save everyone else, that just happens to be a pretty strong metaphor for white Australia's guilt regarding our history with Aboriginal Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
That to me is the thing that's glaringly obvious in the play, and that's the thing that the Aboriginal cast were aware that there's politics just by having Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people together in a play that's about people coming to save you.
Exactly.
You know, it's a metaphor for, this guy coming and wanting to save everyone as though he's perfected now.
Yeah.
That's what people do when they're guilty.
Yeah.
They start talking about how great they are.
But my point is when you've either got this, this is your main thing and you've done your big play for life and you're a one-trick pony, or and then I went, hang on a minute, but possibly you've done the high-altitude stuff, the difficult stuff, with the difficulties of dealing with people that are going to ride you about whether this is going to be controversial or not, or having to dig deep and a difficult topic, try and get, rich Melbourne people to sit down and listen to, what it's like for drunk people in Broome. You know what I mean? Like it's a big thing.
Mm.
But get that out of the system and then your next one, will you be able to go full loose? Do you know what I mean? Like without any inhibitions or worrying about cutting into deadly serious shit.
Well, it depends which one they do. Well, it depends which one they do next. If they do the Hanoi one, I mean, I can't believe the plays I've chosen at this time. Like the Me Too movement has made the Hanoi play look even more shocking on paper because it's about two 65-year-old men in Hanoi getting drunk fighting over a 22-year-old Vietnamese girl.
Right.
And ostensibly that's what it looks like from the outside. But it is a discussion of that, of aging men, of Australia's paternal attitude toward Asia in general.
Yeah.
She kind of signifies that it's about relevance and irrelevance, the sort of all that sort of stuff, and the emerging economies of Asia versus these kind of places like Australia who go over there and patronisingly tell them how to do stuff, but they also want to hear how we've done stuff, and they kind of put up with our stuff. There's a weird relationship, and that's what the play's about. But it's like that's not that much easier because suddenly I'm writing a play about a Vietnamese woman, who the Vietnamese woman slash girl, young woman who is in the development. Yeah. I'm working with her on it now as she's kind of we're meeting and having discussions about the authenticity of the way I'm writing it and whether it's just doing the due diligence of making sure it's not making sure I get it right.
Right. So you're going into the hard topics again.
Well, ages ago. I have no choice.
Weren't a member of the – you weren't in it in the original story. Like Bottomless, you had experience in it. Observationally, you were there.
Yeah, yeah.
Clearly, and you saw this type of behaviour.
Do you know, it's funny, this young woman, Chi, who grew up in Vietnam and came out here to pursue acting when she was like 16 or something, and she's like 21 or 2 now. VCA graduate, I believe. Anyway, she when she first got the script, they sent it to her to get her to take part in the development.
Yeah.
She looked at the script and it had Dan Lee. It said by Dan Lee, and she didn't know anything about me, but she knew the play was about Hanoi. So she looked at my name and she assumed
you're Chinese
that I was Vietnamese or Chinese. Well, Vietnam's. Got a lot, there's a lot of the Chinese were in charge for 1,000 years in Vietnam,
right?
Yeah, before the French, and then the the Japanese and the Americans and the...
Who's in charge now?
The Vietnamese, finally. But everyone's had a go at them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was fascinating because she read it the first time thinking I was Vietnamese. And then at the end of the play, she looked me up and discovered that I was not Vietnamese and then read it again and had two different feelings about the play. Yeah. Based on my ethnicity, which was fascinating, which I talked to her about a lot. And that's what's great about this stuff. And it's what we've sat with Bottomless too, is the discomfort about our feelings on both ends of it.
Yeah.
Like if I'm writing a character who I'm not, but it's funny, as you say, Bottomless, they're not Aboriginal characters in the script. If you read it on paper, there's no reference to Aboriginality. There's no culture. There's no nothing. But they have to be based on it too.
Well, it'd be extra weird
if they weren't.
If they weren't, some of them.
Yeah. You leave it like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that means that the characters are unexpected too. They're talking in a way that's just the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not stereotyped characters of, you know, Aboriginal characters.
Yeah.
But she said the honesty that I was writing about Hanoi coming from these two old white guys.
Yeah.
She thought I was Vietnamese, she was impressed at how accurate an observation of Vietnamese culture it was and of just generally, and then when she read it again, knowing I wasn't, she felt kind of protective of that.
Yeah.
Suddenly I was those white guys. Amazing. All just from
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that the first emotion might be kind of some kind of relief that one of my peers, male peers, aware of this shit.
Yeah, it's kind of courageous in the first instance. Yeah. And then suddenly it's a little bit offensive. She's a little bit protective of it. She's like,
Then it would evolve into a guy who's protective of his own culture and how it's been treated by old middle-aged white guys. And then it's, you know, all right, I'm glad there's middle-aged white guys that are embarrassed and offended by the way their peers are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's great.
Take a while to transition from one thought to the other. But
it's great because it meant we were in a position where we were allowed to be honest with each other. I said to her, I want to know, because I've got at the start of the play these two guys drinking and prattling on about their homespun ideas about what Hanoi is all about.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what's going on. You know, it's crazy, the chaos. They're doing an impression of Western business. They're doing all this stuff. And it's all the things that as Westerners you go to Asian countries and sort of think.
Yeah, yeah.
In a totally sort of racist way, just in a trying to understand this, but slightly patronizing way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've got them doing that so that you get a sense of these guys who mean well, but I'd have no idea, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the girl arrives. So they're talking about her and then she arrives in the second act, so you get to see what's going on. But what was I going to say?
Well, if this was this was obviously written well before the reviews saying, you know, we expect more good things from Dan Lee or whatever they say.
Yeah.
And before you've gone, I can see I've learned some stuff. So this is going to be batch. This is from batch one.
Yeah,
but this I guess you're doing, if you're going to put it on, are you putting this play on? This is news
Reds,
to me.
No, Red Stitch have got it.
So right, okay, and so it's going to happen.
Well, yeah, and they almost programmed it for next year, but they're not quite, they feel like there needs to be a bit more work done on it, which may or may not be true. But that's what I was going to say. She was able to then do it. I said, tell me all about what Vietnamese people think of us in Hanoi. Like, seriously, don't hold back. Like, I've said what, because I don't, no one, there are people out there who are just nasty bastards who hate other people for no good reason or for reasons they think are good, whatever. But most of the observations we make about cultures are just us making observations about cultures, and they may be affected by our biases or whatever. So, for example, Asians are bad drivers, right?
Yep.
People will say that. Now, that's not necessarily racism. It's It depends.
It's generalization.
It's a generalization. It depends how whether you're using it to persecute that person with order to treat them differently, I think. And she and her and I were discussing the way there when people from Hanoi or Saigon move to Australia and they're suddenly put in our traffic that's totally unlike the traffic over there. Their response to it can be unpredictable and peculiar and can make white people driving through Footscray, which is already heavily Vietnamese anyway, go, Jesus, they can't drive, right? Now, there's reasons for the difference in driving, and there's also differences between observing that and using that as a reason to hate Vietnamese people, right?
I was wondering whether it would be the case in whether people that live in, say, Singapore or something quite often sit around the pub going, geez, those Europeans are good drivers, aren't they? It's just not going to be the case.
Well, they sit around talking about how fucked we are in different ways. Like she was saying how the racism in her Vietnamese family about white people, there's a kind of an interest in getting some of the things that we take for granted from us, some of the things we've learnt to do with, developing of business and things like that. But that there's also a deeply patronising thing from them because they look at us as sort of big, doughy, stupid white people who can't look after themselves and need to be told all the time how handsome they are and things like that. And they know what works, you know?
Yeah.
So there's everyone's fucking racist, you know, or degrees of well-meaning or bad-meaning racism. I mean, you look at stuff and you go, that's fucking crazy. These people are nuts. I mean, that's what we all do when we go to places, but not all of us go, and I hate them. Some of us are enthralled by that and want to go, what is going on with this traffic? I want to get in it like I did in Hanoi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's get in it and see what's going on. And I don't for a second suggest that I didn't think it was crazy and that these people are fucking crazy when they're carrying 6-foot sheets of glass on their toes on the back of a scooter while texting in traffic. The glazier down the road from us, that's how he and his brother got glass round. It was on the scooter. To the side, balanced on the end of their toes, and he'd be fucking texting with the other hand, just coming out in a trap. Now, that's fucking nuts until you immerse yourself in the thing and you go in the place and what's going on and you go and you slowly develop this context for it. And your Western idea slips away and then you go, that is happening. Not because they're fuckwits, but because that is the only way it can happen.
It would take 8 hours to get a ute with full safety glass carrying through the traffic.
Any of us would do the same thing given the same context.
Yeah.
Now, and you arrive at that point.
I'd probably put steel cap boots on, but apart from that.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that I don't get there and think these people are crazy, right? But I'm intelligent enough to know that that's my instinctual animal categorizing for security process that we'd all do, our discrimination. Anyway, so that play is not going to be any less controversial possibly, though no one's – it's only controversial for people involved in it.
Yeah.
Really. And as long as it explores those things.
Yeah. So it's happening. That's exciting. Takes away my next question.
Oh, well, it will happen sometime.
We've nearly got to the end of part one.
Have we? The Dan Talks
a Lot. The Dan Talk.
Show.
Where we –
Danny's here.
Where we do that, which I forgot to do at the beginning.
I'll be expecting that whenever I get a phone call.
So that's awesome. So we're summing up, congratulations on the play.
Are you putting an end to my
I love you,
monologue
Mrs.
now?
Yeah. And Fiona,
I was just getting
my wife, she said to me, God, he's a lovely man.
And I thought you were just,
who? 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 What are you talking about?
Where is he?
She goes, Dan. I'm going, what do you mean? I said, when I saw him in the Spiegel tent when the camera went on, I thought, he's fucking good looking. I've never looked at him objectively. You've got to see the two. She goes, no, I don't mean that. I said, are you calling him ugly? She goes, no, I just mean, I'm just telling you, he's just a really lovely soul.
I'm relying pretty heavily on having a lovely soul, particularly marrying someone as out of my league as Missy. you've got to work the nice soul card pretty hard.
Yeah, I work the comedy card. That's about it.
When you've got teeth as blonde as mine, that's what you notice when you're on the telly.
Yeah,
it's all you notice is your teeth.
Is it? Oh, I haven't.
Really, I didn't notice them. Until
I haven't
then.
Been on telly since the Steve Vizard show. <That's>,
which I saw live.
Did you?
Yeah. Because you told us, I think you rang us.
I thought, I reckon one day we'll be digging around in my old man's office and we'll find a video cassette of that and then I'll be very embarrassed.
Yeah.
Although I'll probably look back and more focus on my body.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Oh, and God, how blonde your teeth. I was so skinny and look at my lovely hair.
Yeah.
But I was, stunned mullet.
All those
half a bottle of Cougar before going on live television is probably not the best approach.
All those really vain actors would have to really, the ones who were the sort of Jane Fondas of the world who did things like Barbarella when they were really young, that are the sort of archetypal, gorgeous young woman thing. It must be very interesting being them aging,
Yeah, I think they struggle a lot. But generally.
And how they resist or don't doing all sorts of awful things to themselves to prevent it.
There's just two ways. They can go two ways, like anyone. I see it a bit like an eating disorder. Like if you can't see yourself as a stunt, like if you can't see yourself as being too skinny, you've got an eating disorder. You know what I mean? Like you see yourself as being fat. That's how, pretty sure. I don't know anything about it, but I'm sure that's how it goes. And I think a similar thing happens to people that are not just famous people that are, but just people that are just being hot. You know, like you've been smoking hot and then you get to a certain point when you're still smoking hot, but you don't see it because you see yourself, because of the way people have treated you because you were smoking hot. Mm. You haven't gone through being, you haven't been slowly boiled like a frog, into just being a 70-year-old who is technically smoking hot. You see a 70-year-old and if you see a 70-year-old woman, you go, you would have been fucking hot, right? Sometimes, you do that. Yeah, you can tell. And it must be that thing they go on about symmetry or whatever the formula is to make people good looking. I don't know what it is. But so you see them and you go, if they don't see themselves as being the most beautiful 70-year-old, they see themselves as being haggard and haggard and worn 40-year-olds, then they're in trouble because they go and get all this work done and with all isn't the weird puff up lips and stuff like that.
Isn't it funny?
And it's heartbreaking.
The most beautiful 70-year-olds, men and women, are the ones that have allowed it to all just naturally be. There's a bit of luck involved that you don't just start falling apart. But when people do all that stuff, it just draws attention to how old they are. They must be really old because they look young.
I've been watching a show, scary Stephen King show called Castle Rock, right? And I also watched a bit of one and I had the same Sissy Spacek?
Yeah, she was in Carrie, the original the movie when she was a kid.
And because she's got her nose just kind of points straight up, it's like this tiny little weird nose that points straight up. I was watching a show, I can't remember what it was called, and I'm going, oh, God, why do they do it? And I was having the full tanty, and Fiona's going, what are you talking about? I said, well, look at that. She just should have left herself alone. My wife's going, what do you mean? She hasn't had any work done at all. Look at her nose. She goes, she's always had a nose like that. Nose,
yeah.
Which looks kind of the cutesy little nose, but now that she's playing an old.
Was that Bloodline?
Bloodline.
I noticed her nose in Bloodline. Yeah.
She plays an amazing part, which is kind of poignant.
Speaking of denial, she's in so much denial in that show.
Yeah.
Do you know, I watched the first two seasons. Was it? No, the first season. There's a second, isn't there?
There is. I think there might be even more.
I couldn't watch the second season.
I sort of stopped a bit.
Because it was too hectic.
Yeah.
I was like, the first one is intense and dramatic and Shakespearean.
And had Aussie
great Ben. Anderson. But the second series, they all that heightened bits the whole series was at that level. There was no troughs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do it. I physically was like, this is too stressful.
Yeah, someone's gone, the best part of this fish and chips is the pickled onion.
Right, and then they've
let's fucking serve up a whole plate of pickled onions.
Good, you're good, right. Good, I felt the metaphor. Same.
Just made that up. I quite like that one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So yeah, but the part she plays in this new series I've been watching on TV somewhere, she's got Alzheimer's.
Right.
So it's very, very, very well done. She's just nailed it.
It's the other thing, as an old actor, you start to have to do people dying and stuff, which must be – is either going to help you with your own process. Like as you get close to death yourself, you start being people dying in a bed. There's so many actors and they die and then they have a tribute to them on the Oscars. And
there's already plenty of footage of their dignified finish.
they run through their career and in the last 12 months –
yeah.
Every role they've done has been like this. He's like, oh, fuck. Is that confronting?
I want to know. I've got a question for you. I know you're in the playwright world, but this is probably a question for Hollywood.
Mm.
Especially within the back of your mind, the whole hashtag thing, hashtag Me Too thing.
Right.
Abbreviating too much now.
Mm.
So if you're. Let's say if you write into a movie, you want someone who everyone thinks is ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just in Hollywood? Is it just like brutal? Like, do they just go, oh, you know, like how do you do it? How do you people queuing up? Like, who's the one that says?
Yeah, I know. Brruh,
brruh. I think I've got a job for you. It says we want an ugly person.
They would never write.
What do they say?
They would never write in the script. Margaret is desperately ugly.
No, I know. But
they just write the type of person they are and then the directors and stuff would choose. No, but choose
the other people in the script are going, ugly, you know, whatever. Yeah. However people.
I'm not it must be weird when you are the fucked up dude.
Well, I'm just saying, is everyone professional? Is it super professional where they go, right, okay, you know, you're just playing a bit of a, you know, a bit of a tart, or you're going to play this part, or we need someone that looks a bit rough around the edges or fat or whatever. Do they just, you don't reckon they just say that? They wouldn't tiptoe around it.
Oh, the agents would, but they wouldn't say it to the actor. The agents would all say, have you got any good ugly ones down there today?
Right, okay. So someone rings an agent and gives us a fatty.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And they go, hey, Brianna, we've got a
calorie challenged person, please.
Yeah.
It's like, who are they kidding? Do fat people not, like, are fat people going to get upset because someone, you know?
No, because you want an acting job.
Yeah.
Right? I'm just, my question is not, how matter of fact is everything?
Yeah, I don't
know. When it comes to that, because you've got this hashtag Me Too movement where people aren't allowed to do this, aren't allowed to do this. But then you've got a director going, right, get your gear off and start humping. And I want it to be this kind of one.
There's interesting stuff now about how they handle that sort of stuff. Like
there must be
sex
a lot of
and O-H-N-S. Any sexual content now in rehearsal rooms.
Yeah.
I don't know the specifics, but I know there's lots of new regulations around what they can and can't do. Mm. And they're just starting to not – it's interesting, isn't it? Because you – yeah, what will people just stop including that sort of stuff in plays and films and
well, no, it's TV. Just an incredible wall between
because you're taking sex out of
the director's desire or the art and the people who are in the art.
Mm.
Like it's like this wall that comes up like in a bank, in a robbery, and then you're doing the art and then down again on the other side. You know, like if they cross over, you're in trouble, or if you get creepy, like or in the that whole without. Well, it's probably too controversial, but there's lots of
the
whole Rocky Horror thing.
Yeah, there's loads going on in Australian theatre. There's loads of people like the Jeffrey Rush thing or other things. There's lots that aren't out there being talked about, but there's been a lot of people going to court and you know, making complaints about certain actors doing certain things and theatre companies not backing up their actors, female actors as well. And there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what and when will this whole thing hit rock?
Mm.
And the fuck is it? Is rock and roll still protected? You know, is rock and roll and priests the last people that aren't getting, you know?
Well,
priests, what happens when it hits rock and roll?
Well, exactly. But, and it's like comedians.
The general public will go, no, can't be, because that's where true heroes are at.
Comedy's an interesting one, though, because comedy, you kind of have to be offensive and risk offense. Like part of what humor is to go into these places that are awkward and uncomfortable. And so I reckon comedians are in a really interesting place now because they have to.
It's all knock knock jokes, isn't it? Otherwise, they're in trouble.
but just no one's going to laugh at them. What's his name? Doug Stanhope just goes round telling stories about the untoward things he's done and says, have you been Me Too'd yet to people? And he talks about jerking off in front of women and blah, blah, blah. Now, and how much of that's true, I don't know, but it's about getting a laugh.
Yeah.
It's weird because there's a freedom with comedy then to expose all sorts of social, political issues. Like comedy's traditionally left wing generally. I mean, you've got exceptions, but they're really usually very progressive, right? But part of that is because they get away with, it's not get away with, they go into these places that are uncomfortable, you know?
This came up, funnily enough, this came up yesterday. Mm. I had a podcaster ring me up looking for technical advice on telephone interviews, right?
Mm.
And I went, I was just downstairs at the cafe down here at Casati's. I went, I'll run up and ask Josh from the Daily Talk Show podcast.
Mm.
So I ran up there and I got to their window and they were sitting there with headphones on and microphones. I went, whoa, fuck, and I ran off. And then I heard, come back. And I suddenly became part of a three-way podcast. Mm. Some handsome men. And the exact topic came up.
Right.
And it was like, how far do we go? And I think my answer on the spot was something like, yes, comedians are, if you're considered a comedy act or a comedian, even if you're not that funny, but if that's what you say you are and everything like that, then it is something that people kind of go to or expect to get that relief or to give them, you're part of the tool of them kind of, a bit of relief from something shit that's going on, right? That's part of the game. If you're just a broadcaster, a general broadcaster, and you go on about it, you know, insensitively, or you make a joke when that's not your field, then yeah, you're probably people just go, you're an insensitive prick, whether you are or not. Yeah. We're talking about public opinion. We're not talking about our opinion. And it's funny, you know, that exact same thing came up. So if you launch yourself as a comedian or a comedy podcast or whatever.
The good thing about podcast is the medium encourages discussion and kind of having it out, exploring, make sure. Like I think not the solution, but the way to approach all this stuff is to just talk about all of it because none of us know exactly.
Forgot about the camera, so I'm trying to crack my neck. Sorry.
None of us know exactly where we're part of the problem or not part of the problem. Mm. And we like to think we have to examine our biases and the way we view ourselves compared to the way we really are. Like what really is privilege? Do I really know? Like I can come out with shit here and then next week be going, oh, maybe no one knows everything all the time. The best thing we can do is try to keep exploring it and talking about it.
If you're trying and you run your mouth off.
Yeah.
Like it's, we, but you're willing we're to face for, it. Right? You run your mouth off.
Mm.
It gives an insight into what makes you run your mouth off at that time, that time and space.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, in 10 years' time when they realize everything we've done is wrong and damaging for people for whatever reason that we don't know yet, right, then – and that's the next big topic, not for us but for the world, is when people start – fearing that what they do in the future will be wrong, but that's kind of naive. And that's like, it's kind of like saying it was okay to be Rolf Harris in the 70s and do that shit because there wasn't a system for getting caught.
Right. Yeah, that's like, right.
Get fucked.
We've got nothing to worry about.
It was okay. It's our parents are, we smoked fucking ourselves stupid in the car with the kids in the car with the windows up, you know, and that was okay because we didn't know.
Exactly.
Right? Or we got pissed and we didn't wear seat belts and we drove the cars around. It was okay because we didn't know. No, it wasn't okay for heaps of people who crashed and died, right?
It wasn't okay, but it doesn't mean that they should be retrospectively punished for it because they didn't know at the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so but then there's another tide of, well, what's going to be next? Or when are they going to find out that the way we danced at the nightclubs in the 80s, you know, people that I danced with in nightclubs in the 80s going to start
sending
me solicitor's letters saying the way you danced upset me?
The way people talked 5 years ago is unacceptable now in lots of ways, but we hopefully we just – but I don't know that there is any – no one – who's done it doesn't seem to me like there's this worry with straight white men that they're going to be persecuted and for nothing and all this sort of stuff and everyone's checking what they've said and all this sort of stuff for fear of being me too'd, but no one so far really has been unduly destroyed or punished. There's no doubt that there's been some high profile big things. Leaving Cosby and all that out of it, who are clearly, you know, criminals and lunatics and
cunts.
I mean, say a few people that were been unfairly affected like that. The one they refer to is Aziz Ansari, that Indian American comedian who had a shitty date with someone and they claim they me too'd him in relation to that.
I didn't know
they
about
now,
that.
But my point in bringing that up is that. I'm not sure what that did. If he was accused unfairly, all it did was brought up the discussion to be had about what was going on. And then it seems like the general mood now is, look, there's a difference between being abusive and taking advantage of someone and just being a really terrible date.
Yeah. Right?
Now that's, and I don't know everything about that case, but what that tells me is that people are going to talk it out and you're not going to – I haven't seen anyone get totally fucked who didn't.
Yeah.
It's like – I've just – without mentioning names, there's people who I thought, in the Australian theatre industry, for example, who I've thought, really? I don't know. Maybe that's a bit over the top and unfair. And then you talk to people who've worked with them and they go, no, I'll tell you these stories. And you go, okay. It's come from some – it's, you know – the chances of people having their lives totally destroyed where it's totally unwarranted.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And they need to handle it.
It's going in waves, isn't it? Like, you can't because we're talking about people's heroes. They won't accept it.
Yeah.
You know, they just won't. No, not him.
Well, and no one wants to, do they? Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to.
It's awful. And that's why I'm worried when it hits rock.
What do you mean by it's,
when it hits rock and roll? Yeah. So,
oh, fuck.
I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, that's like.
Well, they may, like, up until recently. Imagine
it's
how. Like,
it's bad enough. Up in the corner there's a musical instrument that my dad's had since the 70s.
Right.
And on the front, on the box, it was endorsed by Rolf Harris.
Yeah, right.
And that's already controversial just to have that in the room. Like, I don't think I'm supporting pedophilia because I've got that there. But what happens when, you know. Yeah. What happens when my record collection behind you starts having to get weeded out?
Dude, man, look.
Like, what does it mean for art when it's already produced? Like, it's an argument that people have not to defend bad behavior, but to defend their consumption of a product by someone who turns to be a bit of a prick.
I think that's always going to be a gray area that I don't think you can. Well, what it strikes me is that people trying to reach a point where there's no discussion on it. There's always going to need to be a discussion. That's the answer. The answer is both internally and amongst you and your friends.
Yeah.
If you like Rolf Harris's early albums and you still listen to them, but you don't appreciate what he's done in the meantime, that just means there's a conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah.
And no one's going to be hating you if you have the conversation. But the problem is we're all trying to get to this point where this person's either in or they're out. And that's just not going to be the case for stuff. What's wrong with the discussion and the understanding? Because then you can at least go, all right, well, I do like Rolf Harris's early albums, and I know it's making you uncomfortable, me using Rolf Harris as an example.
I just don't want people to think that I've got Rolf Harris albums.
Derek Myers is really into Rolf Harris? People will be saying.
Well,
but you know what I mean? It is. Like, why don't we have the fucking, just have the, we just have to think about it and talk about it. Sorry, go on.
No, you're right. It's a bit of a trigger, Rolf Harris, for me, because my nana, who lived in Scotland and I knew when I was a kid before we moved out here, she used to sing Two Little Boys to me and my brother, and it was very emotional. We had the single, and I could listen to it when I was 30 and just weep.
Yeah.
You know, and now it was very emotional.
Or you'll be a sympathizer. Oh,
fuck, you got to be kidding, please.
That's as good as a pedophile.
Exactly. From now on.
Why did Rolf Harris want his kangaroo tied down? that's what Billy Connolly said.
There you go.
Exactly.
He was onto
it. The writing was on the wall.
But yeah, it's like that. So, you know, everyone's very, very defensive about.
There's just no point that has
that
to be arrived at.
From history.
Why do we have to arrive at it?
Yeah.
It's like, and the fear of talking about it, because I don't want to talk about it, but the Woody Allen issue, because that's by no means a clear-cut situation like the Jimmy Savile situation or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the it's not. But it's going to require that everyone talk about it.
Yeah.
And it will have it has a societal developmental effect. The fact that the Woody Allen conundrum exists means, if looking for an upside here, that people are having the difficult Woody Allen conversation. And they're having the conversation about where art meets ethics and blah, 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 blah. So that's what that does.
Yeah.
That's what Woody Allen now does, is causes people to have that at least internal dialogue with themselves, and that's probably a good thing, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Beware. Well, you've dropped us in the deep end.
Yeah.
Again? Well, we're only an hour in, so there's plenty of time to talk about me.
There is still time.
Anything you...
Now, I'll put the timer for 10 minutes.
We're going to have an ad break.
Ad break. Have you got an ad?
No, I'm just pretending we're having an ad break. Hey, Josh. Hey, Bree. I hope you're having a nice time tonight. Tucked up. Snuggled up in bed. I hope you got the aircon on and the doona up under your chin. I hope you're enjoying this song I put on for you, Ravel Bolero. One of the most world-famous lovemaking songs. Made famous in the Dudley Moore film, 10. When Bo Derek, with a hairdo like a tullamarine arrival from Bali, got it on with our duddles. Okay, we'll get back to normal programming. Night night. All right, we're going to...
Did you stop it?
No, I didn't stop it, but in my mind...
You stopped. Should you want to have a little break?
Do you want to have a coffee? Or,
yeah, sure. Let's do that.
Or we can just pound on. I don't care either.
No,
way.
Let's.
I don't have any bodily needs. Let's punch on. 20 minutes. Right. 20 minutes more, and we'll drop an hour and a half show out.
All right, cool. Yeah, let's do that then. Oh, now you're going to have to edit this little bit.
No, I already said we're going to take a break.
Eh?
I'll cut it off when I said we'll take a break.
Oh, so you're going to make two episodes?
No. I'll just go, look, like that, and put them together.
Oh, I'd take the bit in the middle.
Yeah, this bit.
So you do actually edit these shows?
Yeah.
I thought you just go, that'll do.
No.
Have you got the thing that takes out the dead air?
No.
The machine?
It's available, but I don't use it.
You just take all of the breaths out.
Because we've got perfect rhythm.
Why don't you take all the air out of it totally so that it's just like.
It makes people fucking palpitate. It's terrible. I tried it once. I said, I'm going to see what happens. Because you can, there's actually a. Hey, we're back.
No, did you tag it? Did you do your little button tag so you know where to edit it?
No, I don't even do that anymore. Does it,
oh, really?
Does it work?
I thought that's what you do.
Oh, you do, yeah. Oh, I just, I've got to listen. Yeah, you're right. I will do that. I have tagged it now you've said that. Thank you.
So at least I'm still being professional. So how have you been, Derek?
That was a great ad break.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't
Danny's
it?
Still fat. Just for the audience, Danny's still fascinated by the fact that I edit at all.
Well, I didn't know
I
you
don't,
did.
I don't take shit out of our shows.
No, no.
But if you, I say, well, let's take a break and then we chat for 10 minutes and then I go, right, we're back.
Oh, you
it's
just,
not amazing.
You just take that bit out.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
But we were talking in the break, in the ad break. I'm going to leave it in that just to make it make sense. We were talking about how there is a tool in my software where you can choose.
There's a tool in my software.
There's an armor tool.
Oh, no, that track. Sounds even more horrible than I intended it.
So you can choose any silent period under a certain volume or length of time.
Right.
You can have the software replace it with
elevator
zero,
music.
Any amount of silence you like. So you can make it every time there's a pause like that. You can make it say anytime there's a pause like that. So you can take it down to zero. But if you do it, you get palpitations listening.
Right, because there's no air. Because
it's fucking
exhausting.
Because
it means the person listening to it's not breathing either, are they? Because you tend to.
No, yeah, they're not going
with
the rhythm.
So they're never taking a breath.
It's awful. What do you know? Now, we're back in the studio. So much has been happening at Castaway since
yes.
Stan's been doing his play.
Yeah.
Leaving me.
Yeah.
Have a look around now. Let's play the memory game. Anything new you can see?
You've got the docket holder.
Oh, yes.
The docket holder.
Well, I had that
the,
in my
restaurant.
Yeah,
docket
I had an extra
holder.
One from earlier in my
So you
career.
Can put up all your the day's jobs. And you can tick them off as you get them done, Derek. You
no, need a that's spike. Not what it is.
Have you got a spike to put the jobs on and you finish them?
If you look at that, you'll notice one thing about
the is it a timetable?
What it is a how-to for the mixer.
Oh.
So when I teach someone to use the studio and they let themselves in to use the studio, they can get the cheap sheet. And that is also a price list.
I see.
It's like a passive-aggressive way of letting people who might be on a discount or whatever, know if they can't casually glance over there, that's what the actual prices are. Of
Have you thought about making most of your money from extras, like drinks?
A fruit machine.
Like just have vending machines.
Poker machine.
You know, some scones, some whatever, and just try and upsell people with bits and pieces.
It's funny you should say that.
Cushion. You could give them a cushion.
Yeah, I was on a forum where –
That's where the money is.
Yesterday. And someone actually did say, hey, I've got an idea. How much would it be? I want to get some mic. Basically, a podcaster like me who's gone, it's stupid to only use it 1 hour a week. Can I rent it out? And someone said, yeah, I did that. This is what I charged. And I made most of my money out of, I had four studios and it was a big timer, but I made most of the money out of vending machines.
Yeah.
Podcasters having to go, let's take a quick break and get a can of Coke or whatever.
Do you know how much people make off those vending machines at Richmond Station and Flinders Street?
Nuts.
Apparently it's just outrageous.
Mm.
So, yes.
What else can you see?
Well, that great luminous ring. I don't
know I've got a shiny,
what's that
enormous
for?
Shiny ring, and it's to my right. Well, it doesn't live there, but it's for when I do my videos, snippets. So it just creates a diffused light.
Right. You put it in front of you or behind the camera sort of thing.
You put it off to the side of you. It's working on me right now.
Right. Is it giving you a kind of fresh and youthful appearance?
I think so. Let's have a look. Do I look youthful and stuff? Yeah, it's just light.
Right. Okay.
So there's less kind of intense.
And you got the new Steven Spielberg style, what's it called? Monitor for the camera.
Is it really that new? The camera that I've got set up to do streaming type stuff. Yeah, it's got a little monitor on the top. So
yeah,
the computer is operating with the door because I'm recording.
Yeah,
that's the audio is the most important thing.
Yeah,
and so there's an extra screen that shows the streaming software. So it means you can look down the barrel of the camera and still see that you've got the right, you know, the right thing.
Now we have to suck our guts in the whole time we're doing the podcast.
I've given up. I gave up. Yeah, just wear a black T-shirt. It's fine. I don't have a big enough hard drive to record every podcast and video, so forget it. What else is new? Well, let me talk about the podcasts that have been recorded in here. It's been very exciting.
Okay. Who have you had?
Sean Whelan on Thursdays is still going. And
The play, the audio radio play?
It was awesome, yeah.
Fuck, I haven't listened to it yet. I better listen to it.
Yeah, that's great. That's what you need as a producer when the talent comes in and says, "Oh, today's episode is going to be a bit different. It's a radio instead of a poem. It's a radio play, and you're in it. Here's the script.
Yeah,
first draft script.
Was it just the two of you?
No. It was. I'll have to get back to you on the name. Melita.
Yeah.
Rian or something like that.
Yeah.
Screenwriter.
Yeah, I think I know who you mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she wrote one as well. Really good.
Cool.
I enjoyed it because I was asked to try and put the sound of the ocean over her play.
Right.
And I had to try and find a sound effect of sea glass? I don't even know what that was.
Sea glass,
you know, glass that rolls up on the beach.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
I just assumed it was from old broken bottles, but maybe it's something to do with silicons and the sand or something. I'll never know. Anyway, so I thought, hey, where the fuck am I going to get the sound of someone holding 20 pieces of sea glass in their hand?
You go and get sea glass and make it yourself.
No, fucking YouTube.
Yeah.
There it was.
Yeah, I suppose.
Have you heard the creepy new, the creepy new trip that people are on where people release these videos and audios
of them touching
just weird
things.
Little sounds? Yeah. There's one of those where someone's holding sea glass, going tiddling, tiddling, tiddling. It's like,
do you like that, dear? Do you like it? Do you like that? Yeah, it's like, do you like the sound of that? Ooh. Yeah. It's called. It starts with A. AMSO or something, it's all stuff that makes you feel good by the sound of it.
We don't know why, but it
effect.
Works.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was that, and that was exciting. And then there was a rapper in yesterday called 1/6th,
right?
And he plays with the Public Opinion Afro Orchestra,
okay,
which is exciting. But let's talk about. Da, 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 da. The name dropping king, Michelle Laurie has been started recording her Australian true crime podcast from here.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, good for me. I'm really chuffed because I got to engineer a special edition that she put out during the week.
Yeah,
where I didn't edit it; I just recorded it for her. And, where she had Rachel Brown. Who did Trace for the ABC.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the Northcote, Maria James.
Oh, I haven't listened to that yet, but I saw it there.
Yeah, which is huge. So cool. I had sitting there kind of, you know how I get. I'm a bit starstruck. Yeah. And I had sort of podcasting royalty sitting in here chatting away. I didn't have to. I didn't have to instruct them on how to use a microphone.
No,
put it that way.
Sure. How did Michelle Laurie find you?
Barney Banana.
You what?
A friend called Barney.
Right.
Yeah.
She
grew up with his brother. And
well, you are
he
well
must have
connected,
just said,
Derek.
Well, it's you don't know what connection's
you know,
going to.
You've been in Collingwood a long time. You know everyone.
That is true. So anyway, so she came around, had a look at the place and it was like, this is cool. This is perfect.
Yeah.
So that's on. She's got a couple of podcasts.
And is she going to do them here?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So sweet. Pretty excited. That's called Australian True Crime.
Cool.
And
so it's becoming a.
I had a look at it because I'm not really a true crime. Look, it sounded weird yesterday on the Boys podcast when I told them all about the results of Teacher's Pet and Trace, and they're all getting a result in the actual real world of, you know, prosecutions and stuff.
Yeah.
And a few others.
Yeah.
Blood on the Tracks and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But to me, they're not. that's their one-off things on a case.
Right.
But I'm not really a true crime addict kind of thing.
No,
brings me down a little bit.
Yeah,
listening to the descriptions of murders and things like that.
Yeah.
But Michelle's one is interesting because she goes into, like a topic, like a subject-based thing and goes and interviews police. She interviewed an old woman.
Oh, so it's not crime by crime. It's more topics.
Style of crime. Right. Or this. Yeah.
So people who do this and then it's across the board sort of look at the pathology of a certain.
Yeah, like an open.
Oh, that's interesting.
Open style of journalism about true crime and true crime podcasts.
Yeah,
so she had, she had Rachel Brown on her show.
Right.
When that broke, broke through.
Okay.
That, you know, what's been happening.
Yeah.
So there was a big breakthrough on that, and then there was a big breakthrough
in the
Sydney one as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's fascinating.
So you've had stuff coming in here a bit then.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
So the studio's kicking off a bit more.
You might get off your knees in the end after all.
No, I doubt that.
Meaning scooter mechanicking.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant just live your life on your knees. Financially.
You won't be able to give away the blowjobs entirely. the scooter mechanicking, you might.
You've got to do what you've got to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you're right. The scooter thing's kind of, I've got the new studio set up, which is. Kind of gone to a few days a week.
So we're going to go to YouTube, which means we have to make our shows more theatrical, you know? I mean, I wonder what's to be gained.
We have to wear more colour.
I wonder what's to be gained by looking at us. Like you watch Rogan and it's not like they do anything. Like they still just sit here and talk like this. They don't have show and tell.
I haven't seen it.
You've never watched Rogan?
No.
But you'll do a 3-hour interview and it'll be on video and you're just watching them talking like this.
You know what? YouTube
but there is something about
YouTube's
seeing someone's
platform,
face.
Even if it's, even if it's just a photo and the audio, it's a real easy platform to use.
Yeah.
If you say,
the expression of the face, even when nothing's happening, does give you some extra to the.
Yeah. If someone's comfortable or uncomfortable, sitting back
might
like
be
that.
Negligible, but. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway.
You know they're saying it.
Yeah.
You're reminded constantly.
But I still think
we're stunningly
handsome. We should get theatrical, though. I still think we should.
He's going to bring props in next week, and I'm going to go,
I
sold the camera.
I want to just have a nervous-looking donkey standing there, an actual live donkey in the background, and we never refer to it, never say anything.
Already given it away.
And it's just standing there going. Or a goat? I'd settle for a goat.
I was just about to say.
But a goat bananas in here, you'd have to, it'd be eating the curtains and fucking everything.
Yeah. I think another person.
Another person?
We're in Collingwood. You've got to use your resources.
Let's just get a person
There's
to sit
there. There's people everywhere around here, no goats.
Every time they try to speak, we'll go, like that. That'd be fun. Now that we're a visual medium as well. Though you just said you don't have the hardware to actually. Do YouTube as an ongoing thing.
No, I do, but I just said that.
This said
that's
that
a lie.
It's because you don't want to get stuck in that whole thing.
Well, this setup is.
It's because you don't want to have to brush your hair and put your pants on, isn't it?
Pretty much. This setup here is a streaming setup. So it's taken me a while to get it sorted. But if we look at me,
hi,
and then Dan says,
Guten Tag.
He's leaning back, so I have to adjust that. I didn't bet on that. And look, you need to look at this, Dan. You're not in it, but there's a special feature.
Yeah.
Do you see my little head in the corner?
Yeah, and it's
cool, isn't it?
Where's the camera from above?
Oh, it's up here.
Oh, wow.
And there's all of us. There's both of us from above. But you can put little – this is a picture of – this is a picture that I left on from Sean's one, but you can put a picture up, and have your little head still there. If you're doing a one-on-one, kids do it when they're doing their gaming thing. Their little heads in the corner.
This is where you're getting it from.
Yeah, so this is set up for gaming, so we can record. You can just send it out live, but the thing is, this is a recording. I have to fucking edit it. That's why we don't do video. In the past.
Right.
Because I lose 5 hours editing the fucking video.
But theoretically, wouldn't it just be the same?
It is, but the audio would be on, like this, the audio that I'm recording now is in that computer as a Adobe Audition file project. Mm. But if that was just the camera recording, then that would be on an SD card. So I'd be like putting the SD card in the computer and matching them up, going, oh, I'm not happy with that. This is what it is. This is recording, hopefully, on the computer. Maybe it isn't.
I've just got struck by the fact that this is not a very exciting conversation we're having. Techniques of the thing.
After 1 hour and 25, if you're still on board, well, you're fucking probably asleep.
You've gone
to sleep, and you're going to wake up in the morning wondering what we talked about anyway.
If you've nodded off.
Boo! Yeah, so that's what's been happening
for
here.
For those of you who live alone. Remember that?
No.
Billy Connolly?
No.
He was saying how they used to do that on the TV. At the end of the night, they'd say, don't forget to turn your television off and, you know.
Oh, really?
And how it was just pointing out how lonely people were. If you live alone, don't forget. And, anyway. Oh. You know.
Well, that was Grouse. And why are you here?
What happened? I had a moment.
I was fantasizing about a Christmas special. Oh, no.
Oh, no, it's all right. I'll move the car soon.
Oh. I was fantasizing about doing a Christmas special and just getting you in here.
Yeah.
And getting the lads in from the other podcast and having a cake and some pudding or something and having a Christmas irritatingly talk over each other chit chat.
We could try a four-way one.
Yeah.
Would that be interesting?
Yeah. All right, it'll be good.
Give it a go.
Yeah.
There might be more times in the next couple of weeks with any luck.
I'm cool.
It's getting increasingly difficult with the two, obviously.
There's actually a Christmas period calendar on my clip that you were talking about before.
Yes.
But anyway, I think we'll wrap up the show now. We'll talk about this technical shit up. That was Grouse Dan. Thanks for coming in.
No problem, mate.
See you soon. How long have people got for Bottomless?
14th. It finishes. So another week.
Yep, one more week. In there, Jimmy.
You've already seen it, Mum, and you're seeing it again on Sunday, so don't worry. This is for...
Oh, fuck, I nearly forgot.
What?
I found Cherie.
What about her? What?
Is it Cherie?
I think
our listener.
Yeah.
Right, as well as your mum.
She is.
Yeah, no, I found where she talks to us, and I feel a bit guilty. Sorry, Cherie. Twitter.
What do you mean where she talks to
us? When you do something, you get yourself an Instagram account.
Right.
Right. And then you get a Facebook page and you get a Twitter account.
Right.
That's what I've done for What Now.
Right.
So there's all those three things.
Okay.
But what I do is I just use Instagram and that throws it up.
Right.
At the same time, it throws it up to Twitter.
Yeah.
And Facebook.
Yeah.
And I don't look at them.
Right.
It just throws it up. So one day if we do start twittering.
Twatting.
Yeah. I can jump on there and we've got a history on
so
there.
So you went and checked out the twatting.
I had a look at the twatting. I went, oh, fuck, there she is. And she was saying stuff to us. And,
oh, really?
Unreplied.
Oh.
You know, responses to our having her on the show.
Just can't. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah, oh, bugger. Well,
sorry.
You have to read them to us at some point.
Will I do it now? Do you reckon it's possible?
I don't know. What did you? Okay. Well, yes. People would assume that you look at your twatting.
Yeah, I felt really guilty. I went, oh, there.
Did you send her a message saying, by the way, I haven't been avoiding you?
I think I thought, right, I'm going to talk about this on the show, and that will be where I send my message. So this is it. Sorry about that.
You say you just didn't see.
Yeah.
Derek.
I know.
You need an apprentice.
We need a guy who sits there, not a donkey, sits there and reads our Twitter for us.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to do that right now. That'd be just
Did you get
silly.
Any massive increase in downloads since the play? I thought that people might have looked up Bottomless and that, you know, when you look up the play and you look at the reviews, just underneath that is What Now podcast with Bottomless, a play about alcoholism, that episode.
Oh, wow.
So I wondered if things had picked up at all from that.
I think there was a little burst there.
Yeah.
I'll have to look at those stats.
Yeah.
Afterwards, but I just suddenly realised we haven't looked at Skype either.
Oh, Derek.
Well, sorry. I thought we closed down for the year.
It's not like you've had anything else going on.
They won't. There's nothing there.
Yeah. That's all right.
People still
This is probably not great. podcast material.
It's shit. People still say, "Oh, I left you a message on your thing," and I'm still not seeing any.
This is where I'm in luck because I don't have any of that stuff. But I think the point is we apologise to Cherie for not responding to her.
Sorry, Cherie.
Twats, and we'll twat at her.
We're all over Instagram. Mm. That's our thing.
Well, you are, not me, but yes.
The royal hour.
But I did go on Instagram for 45 downstairs, remember?
Ah, yes. Yeah. They let you on a...
Yeah, for 48 hours.
Did you get that feeling again?
Yeah, it was horrible. I kept checking it every 30 seconds. It's fucked. Yeah. Fucked.
No, stay away.
Yeah.
Stay away from what hurts.
Awful, awful.
Let's go get a cup of tea.
Let's do it.
All right.
Bye, everyone. Folks.
What is this? What now?
That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com. Or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.